Good morning. Welcome to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Little Jimmy Buffett getting us started. And we are all keeping our thoughts and prayers with the people of Florida as Hurricane Irma bears down on them. And just a thought from Tony and I and John, our producer. Donate to the American Red Cross wherever you possibly can. And I think Matthew 25 Ministries also is collecting a bunch of things for those who are in the path. But we've got a lot of ground to cover today. Weather has been spectacular, Tony.
Good morning, by the way.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for the good morning invitation to me.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Tony.
Thank you, buddy. Right back at you.
Yeah, how are you?
Doing well. How
was your vacation?
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Good.
Yeah, when you can get out on the Oregon coast,
yeah,
it's nothing but spectacular. Beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And that is, as a matter of fact, that is where all the cool plants come from. Everything out there just grows so well.
Wow. I thought they all came from our locally.
They do.
They got to start somewhere.
Yeah, they have to start somewhere.
And you posted some fantastic pictures we're going to be talking about too on our Facebook page. So early this morning, jump on Facebook, look us up and like us and check out some of those pictures. And Tony's going to be explaining some of those. But, you know, it just seems like yesterday we were talking about the beginning of summer.
Mm-hmm.
And how quickly it was going to pass. And here we are, the first week of September. And have you had some pumpkin spice latte yet?
No. Have you?
I have not.
I saw where Statman did. I think that, did he do a little spoof on the radio the other day with the pumpkin latte?
Pumpkin spiced dog food that I guess he tried.
Oh, it was dog food.
Yeah, I kind of got lost in that whole thing. But it is kind of funny where all that stuff is starting to surface, and you'll see a lot of those Halloween decorations already out in your stores.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't want you to rush into any other season other than what we're enjoying right now.
This has been awesome. I love this weather, and I think the summer, too, for the most part.
Uh-huh.
We have to be somewhat satisfied. I have been, so. You know, we've had some cooler temperatures, typically not what we were used to seeing, and especially the weather now, crazy. I know when I was gone last week that there were some days we were here in the Cincinnati area in the 60s.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
It's just incredible. You were out of town for a little while.
Went down to Cumberland a little bit for a couple of days and came back. And, of course, we knew going in we were going to be in that rain. So it rained for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly why we went down there, to get off the grid and away from everything else. And then a couple of nice days before we came back up. And
it's nice to get off the grid.
It is.
Leave the phone. Did you leave the phone at home?
Didn't leave it at home, but where we were at this friend's farmhouse, there is no service. There is no internet. Occasional electric.
Mm-hmm.
And running water once in a while, too. So it was kind of nice.
It is nice to get away. Just get off the grid, like you said, and relax. Yeah. You know, once Labor Day's here, like last weekend, everyone always says, hey, that's the end of summer. We still have a few more days left of summer.
Yeah.
I don't want to burst your bubble by any means, but, you know, it's been a great summer. I think the weather's been great. Yeah. We've had timely rainfalls. There's been some situations, too, where I noticed that the lawn would get a little dry. I turn on the old irrigation system, you know, satisfy that thirst.
Right.
But I've been pleased. I don't know about you. Everyone's lawns are looking good. They're still green.
Yes, yes. Very nice indeed.
What else? What more can you ask for?
Well, I wanted to ask you, since we do have these crisp fall temperatures right now, what about our lawn? What about the fall application?
What about the lawn?
It's all about
the lawn right now. And, you know, honestly, we're going to talk a little bit, too, here this morning about the Fertilum three-step program.
Mm-hmm.
And the fall is the best time to get into that program.
Yes.
If you've yet to do it, or if you want to take that project on yourself and do it for the very first time, it's a no-brainer. It's, you know, it's one of those things you stop by your local garden center, you pick up what you need to pick up, the Lawn Food Plus Iron, that's the orange bag. And I encourage people to do it now, Ernie, so you can see that deep, rich green color that the Lawn Food Plus Iron is going to bring you.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with these cooler temperatures. And even better, I'm not quite sure with Irma, how when Irma comes up and just comes up into the middle part of the country, if we see some of that rain, it's going to be perfect timing. So if you can get that down this weekend, you know, tomorrow, Monday, before Tuesday and Wednesday, we get some of that rain.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't ask for anything better from Mother Nature.
Sure.
From that standpoint. Now, the folks on the coast, looks grim down there.
Boy, it does.
You know, could you imagine being in the Keys?
No.
But hopefully some of that rain will benefit us, and it can benefit us in that way that we're fertilizing our lawn for the first time this fall. Take advantage of it. Get out to your local garden centers and nurseries. Pick up the three-step program. And again, if you're doing this for the very first time, get with one of the staff members at your local garden center. Just let us know. Let someone know, you know, how big of an area that you have to work with.
Mm-hmm.
We're willing to even loan you a spreader, and the settings are preset, and have at it.
Speaking of the weather, it is going to be spectacular today. Temperatures are expected to climb to the low 70s. Lots of sunshine. Overnight low 48. Tomorrow back to the mid 70s. More sunshine. And then again on Monday, we're not expected to see what the effects of Hurricane Irma here in the tri-state until Tuesday, late Tuesday, early Wednesday, when there is some rain in the forecast. Then it's only going to be those 2 days, right back to sunshine and beautiful, beautiful weather. So if you get a chance, get out in your lawn. And you mentioned color. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about don't rush to pick up those mums. When we come back, we'll tell you about that. In and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Ernie. I'm glad you made it today. Thanks for coming in.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, a couple of weeks ago, we started seeing these things surface in some areas, and you mentioned about mums, and it's one of our favorite fall plants, but you can get caught sometimes by picking them up too early or from the wrong locations and being dissatisfied with how they look.
Yeah, well, what you just said is kind of yeah, kind of no.
But, well, thanks for putting me on the spot.
Well, no, I just, I have to bring it back into perspective here with that.
Well, I was just quoting you.
It all really depends on what it is that you have going on at home or maybe at work or church or whatever. When we talk about mums and you find mums where they're really in full bloom or showing a lot of color,
mm-hmm.
Keep this in mind. And this is what Ernie's really talking about. Is that the fact of the matter is those moms have been forced. You know, they're grown in such a situation where we forced them to bloom a little earlier than normal, how we're accustomed to seeing them, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the temperatures have been great. However, if it's normally, you know, what our temperatures are at this time of year where it's still quite warm, you don't always get that longevity out of your moms. However, if you're having a get-together and you need some color right away, the forced moms are perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to look at it from the standpoint, do you need color right now or not necessarily? And you can postpone it and put it off and buy something that's really, really tight in bud,
right?
Which is ideal. So most of your mums that you see here locally that are grown locally, they're just coming on. Some are just cracking a little bit of color. And if you're not sure of the color, most growers, there's a tag inside the pot mm-hmm. that will give you an idea of that color. And while I talk about the tag, that tag is not always the perfect representation of the color of that mum. It's fairly close, but that just kind of gives you an idea.
Sure. Yeah.
So what you just said is spot on. You know, just depends on if you need color right away, look for something that's been forced to shade it and get that color. And then once those blooms expire, maybe just chuck it or plant it, do whatever you want with it. And come back and pick up some other mums.
We're going to come back to the mum conversation in just a few minutes. We have a listener on the line, Bill from Independence, and he's got a spreader question for you. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Ernie. How are you?
Doing wonderful. What kind of, what, you having an issue with your spreader, or do you need one?
I've got an old Lesco spreader, and I can't remember what to set it on, A, B, C, D, you know, up through there. I was wondering how wide the hole had to be when it lets the granules out. Because if you set it too wide, it's going to be too much run out on the ground.
It doesn't go all the way to Z, does it, Bill? You might as well just throw it on the ground.
Just about, yeah.
You know, it's funny you just brought that up because I have a spreader setting sheet in front of me, but you're not going to like this.
Uh-oh.
I don't have any info on the Lesco spreader.
That's what I've looked all over, and I can't nothing on. I mean,
yeah.
I've had it for 15 years, but it's still a damn good spreader, and I don't want to throw
exactly,
it away.
Exactly. Do you know what the square footage of your lawn is when you're applying the fertilizer?
No. My yard is huge.
Yeah, that it is. I know, Bill.
Like 6 acres, and I don't want to. I just want to do the front and the backyards.
Right.
But if I got any overflow, you know, I put it back there.
You know, Bill, I will look into that. Lesco definitely has to have some information on it. Do you have a model number that you can give me?
Oh, no, not with me. I'm up eating breakfast. I don't have it with me. If I can, I'll give it to Ernie if I can get a hold of it.
Okay.
If there's one
yeah,
on there.
I will find out. I'm sure that, you know, there are businesses here locally in the Cincinnati area that sell a lot of Lesco products.
Right.
Lesco, you know, does a great job with their products. So I know that we can still get that information for you.
Right.
You know, typically, you know, if you're ever in question about the spreader setting, I kind of just encourage people to finagle with it, tune it up a little bit to your liking, and don't try and spread it all with a, I want to say it, like a heavier spread right off the bat.
Right.
If you have to come back and go opposite directions, I'd rather you have to do that than all of a sudden go through a whole bag.
Right.
And it's like you need more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I do all the time. The only thing is I got my grandson doing it now because my legs are hurt so bad. So when you tell him, he just opens it up and lets it go. So if I don't know where to put it at,
mm-hmm.
the braces, you know what I mean?
I know exactly what the grandson's philosophy is. The sooner it's out of that spreader, I'm finished.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I can go on. Well, I'll tell you what, Bill, we'll get that information for you, and then I'll bring it down to the garage. We'll see if we can't get Tony to stop by.
Yeah, stop by on Friday.
Have a little refreshment.
There you go.
I sure appreciate it.
All right, Bill, have a good weekend.
Talk to you. Bye.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. When we come back, going to continue our conversation about fall mums.
We'll also want to pick up, too, on those spreader settings. That's really interesting, and we can find that out.
Okay, we'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And we're going to revisit Bill's question about the spreader. But right now, Tony, we have Wendy on the line from Amelia who has a strawberry question for you. Hi, Wendy. Thanks for the call. What's going on?
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, listen, got a little issue of my son's house.
Uh-huh.
We've got a 6x6 strawberry patch that over the last few years has turned into 20x20.
Wow, yeah.
And my daughter-in-law has finally listened to me and her grandmother about thinning it out.
Mm-hmm.
Can we is this a good time to transplant? I've got a patch I would like to put them in.
Yeah, go ahead and get them in. The sooner the better because they're going to get rooted in.
Right.
Definitely thin those out. A good practice, as soon as you harvest, you know, you need to really renovate those beds immediately after harvest.
Well, me and her grandma have been trying to tell her that for years.
Right.
And she wants to be a farmer. She's working on it.
The learning curve.
Yeah, no. And are the strawberries, are they June bearing? Or
yeah, they're June bearing.
Okay. Which I prefer because you can get them all in one picking. A lot of people like the everbearing. But typically, you'll get, 3 years out of one of the main parent plants.
Well, and that's what we've been trying to tell her.
Mm-hmm. And you're trying to, encourage runners and get those runners started. And that's why you need to thin that bed out and take out the non-producing vines. And another tip, too. Really, weed control is huge with strawberries, you know, keeping it weeded, the beds, and keep them mulched with straw or plastic.
Oh, yeah.
So, you'll have great strawberry
production. Like I said, Mom always did it right after harvest, and
mm-hmm.
That's why I'm like, yeah, I really want to bring some down here, but.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. They root rather quickly.
Okay.
So you should be fine. You have nothing to lose anyway. So.
Right.
Go for it.
I do have another question.
Uh-huh. All right.
Friend of mine loves flowers, hates to play in the yard. I bought her some lavender. It's phenomenal lavender.
Yeah, it's a really
a hardy,
good one.
Uh-huh. It's a hardy one.
Mm-hmm.
But these came in little 3-inch pots,
mm-hmm.
and they got put in pots, bigger
mm-hmm.
pots, because mm-hmm. she doesn't really have any place to plant it.
Right.
And I told her at the end of the season I was going to bring them home because I have the place to put them.
Right.
Well, one place I have is like out in the open because, guys, really, they haven't grown but 2 inches. Would I be better putting them all up against the house at least for this winter?
Well, I tell you, what you want to make sure, a couple things with lavender.
Uh-huh.
One is where they're located. They're best suited in the ground.
Right.
Anytime you're above ground, that's a great question that you're posing right now because...
Well, that's why I want to get them out of the pots. I don't think they'll survive the winter in pots.
Things behave totally different. Now, you could plant that whole pot in the ground, but you better make sure you get adequate drainage.
Right.
And, you know, mulch accordingly, you know, 2 to 3 inches around it. Or you have the other option of bringing it into the garage, and you'll back off your watering tremendously. So, you know, that's usually the demise of lavender is going through the winter in a wet spot.
Right.
But, if you put it up against the house, I would definitely mulch heavily around it, that whole pot, just protect it. And putting it on the sunny side of the house, too, is going to be even more of a benefit.
Right, because I know they do like full sun.
Right, and therefore, you know, when the sun's beaming on the side of the house, hopefully you can get some of that heat that radiates off of the brick or off of the siding or off of the concrete.
Right.
But, I would be more apt to bring it into the garage. But that's your call. But, you know, give it a whirl. I mean, you said you bought a 3 or 4 inch pot.
They were 3 inch pots.
You know, that's not going to break the bank by any means.
No.
So give it a shot. And if you do it in a pot and leave it out, definitely follow up with us next spring. I would like to know what you did and if it wintered over or not.
Yeah.
Well, I've got 2 of them, 1 in each pot. Mm-hmm. I may just experiment.
Sure.
Yeah.
You don't have anything to lose.
Right.
And that is one of the newer varieties of lavender that's really... gotten a lot of attention and is in the spotlight now.
Well, I like the leaves on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's been like a silver green all summer.
Right.
It's really pretty.
Yeah, it's one of the more popular lavenders. And, but I know severe winters can do them in. And back in 2012, the following spring, I think we had record lavender sales for us at Jackson Florist and Garden Center because a lot of people lost lavender.
Right. That was my concern.
Yeah,
you guys talking about
you
that.
Could very well
I've
lose
never done
that.
Lavender before.
Right. You could very well lose that because it's in a pot and above ground. But let us know what you do.
Okay, I sure will.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye, Wendy.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks, Wendy. 749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. When we come back, we're going to revisit
the spreader setting. I found it for Bill.
Okay.
And then we'll talk more on moms.
All right. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We're going to revisit a question our buddy Billy Eggleston from Independence posed, wanting to know a little something about a spreader. And Tony has done a little digging.
I found a Lesko spreader.
And
so there are 2 types.
You're going to spread the information.
I'm going to spread it. I'm going to spread it out there.
Go ahead. Squeeze the trigger and start rolling.
I was surprised to, it's not often. I'm not that familiar with seeing spreaders that have letter settings, but Lesko has a couple of spreaders, one with letter settings, like Bill described, and one with numbers. So I found the Lesko with letters, and it looks like C1.
Oh, so it has letters
it's got a,
and
well, it's
numbers.
Got a number after it.
Oh.
The others don't, you know. But this particular setting, and maybe it's just C on Bill's, I'm not really sure. But what we're trying to do is we want to put down 1 pound of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet.
Okay.
So C1 should be the right setting. So anyway, Bill, let us know one way or the other.
Yep.
And we'll see
C1.
C1.
C1B1.
I can't. That's not even. That's not even. It's like bingo.
Yeah. So we'll still bring that information down to the garage on Friday just
you,
to make
you
sure.
You got it.
He may have turned his attention to his breakfast, but we'll get that information.
We'll see what's going on. And it's just ironic that or coincidental that I had this chart in front of me because a lot of times people get a little confused about some of the settings with their spreaders. Mm-hmm. And some spreaders, they don't even come with settings.
Right.
You know, and you're trying to rely on what's on the backside of the bag.
Right.
But always look up the information as best you can or call someone at a local garden center or nursery. And if mm-hmm. we don't know right away, don't jump to conclusions and just go right at it. Give us a couple of minutes or a moment to get back with you so you can put down the right application, you know, the right amount.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. More is not better.
Right. And you don't want to waste the product.
You do not want to waste the product. And the Lawn Food Plus Iron, you know, for example, if you buy a bag and it's 5,000 square feet, you know, roughly there's about, you know, 4 to 5 pounds of nitrogen in that 20-pound bag. So therefore, 5,000 square feet, you're roughly getting 1 pound of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. So that's the basis that I came across to pass along to Bill. So C1, Bill. And also, most spreaders, well, what we loan out at Jackson Florist is an Earthway spreader. Earthway also, or used to, I'm not quite sure where it is today, they would also manufacture the spreaders for Fertilume. So with the Lawn Food Plus Iron, that is the orange bag, you want to set that spreader setting, if you have an Earthway or a Fertilume spreader, to 14. So that's mm-hmm. the opening that will give you the right amount of application when you start putting down your fertilizer if you're doing it yourself. Taking it over to the Scotts Broadcast Spreader, the Speedy Green. Now, this is where there's been a lot of questions and problems with what is the right setting. And what I show here on this chart is 6 would be the correct setting for the Scotts Broadcast Speedy Green fertilizer unit. So
right. Okay.
6 is what you want to set that to. The Republic, that broadcast spreader, you'll set that to a 5. And from that's pretty much what I have in front of me.
Okay.
So if there's any questions, feel free to give us a call on the spreader settings, and we'll do what we can do to help you. And if not, we'll certainly get back with you and give you the right information.
Mm-hmm. 749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And we started off a few minutes ago talking about some mums, and we're going to come back to that, with promise. We also have another caller. Carla from Loveland is worried about overseeding, since we were talking about how important it is, and this is the proper time to get some grass seed down.
It is.
Carla, how big of a lawn do you have?
About an acre of grass.
Okay. And how's the condition of the lawn right now? Is it a little sparse? Okay.
Well, right. I treated it for nutsedge.
Uh-huh.
And now I've got a lot of brown patches.
Right. Well, hopefully
and
the nutsedge is
gone.
There's
a lot of weeds, but I thought I'd tackle those in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you use for the nutsedge?
Sedge hammer.
Okay. I'm familiar with that. But I'd have to look up and see what the amount of time that's necessary to wait before you can reseed.
It was 6 to 8 weeks.
Oh, yeah, then follow those. I love you. I'm glad you read the directions and the information on the label. That is so important. So, so important.
It's helpful.
It is. Unfortunately, you're going to have to wait that period.
I have. It's
oh,
been,
so you have, okay, so we've expired that period, that waiting time. Okay.
Right.
So you're ready to sow grass seed.
Correct.
Is that correct?
My question is, I have grass seed I was going to do with a drop spreader.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought the starter fertilizer with a broadcast, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And use the broadcast spreader with your grass seed if you want to. It's a lot easier than the drop.
Okay.
But that's your choice, you know. I mean, you can throw it out there by hand, too. But what you need to do, what has died, you know, make sure that you rake and discard all of that to where you get really good soil-to-seed contact when you sow your grass seed. And whatever seed...
I've got some of it, but I have to do the rest of the lawn.
Yeah, and don't till your lawn. That's, you know, it's really not necessary.
No.
Yeah, I just want to point that out. That's one of the things you don't want to do is really rototill your lawn, because what's ultimately happening is as those tines on that rototiller turn down into the dirt, it's bringing weed seed to the top that's been 4 or 5 inches underground for a number of years and exposes it to sunlight, and all of a sudden you're seeing weeds. So
aerated it all yesterday, so we're trying to get everything in a row.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, you can aerate and sow grass seed at the same time. There's people that will say don't do it like that. I mean, you're going to lose a little bit of seed in those plug holes, but certainly not that much to where it would prohibit you from doing so. Did you moisten the lawn? Was it moist enough to pull out nice core plugs?
It was pulling about an inch.
Yeah,
so
you should be pulling a good inch or so in it with a good core aerator. And that moisture is so important to have that right moisture amount in the soil to do that. So, and don't rake those plugs up. Leave them, allow those to lie around because they're very beneficial. What you're doing is you're pulling up these core plugs that actually have a lot of beneficial microbial activity that it will break down. And
I should have raked before we aerated.
But, yeah, you just see what happens. What kind of seed are you using?
It's a tall fescue blend.
Perfect, perfect. Well, you're right at the right timing. You've waited the 6 to 8 week period for sowing your grass seed after you've gotten rid of your nut sedge. And let us know how it goes.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks for the to the call, Carlin. 749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Got to pause for a moment, and when we come back,
mum's the word.
Mum's the word. We'll be right back. Welcome back, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And mum is the word. We were talking about that a little bit ago, and some of our listeners had some questions about different things, but we wanted to come back and revisit the mums. And I had a few questions for Tony. Tell me about the different types, and what's the difference between a hardy mum and those that aren't?
Well, there are also what we call florist mums that really aren't hardy. And typically you'll see those at various times throughout the season, like early in the spring, around Easter, and so forth. Those are forest, you know, just to give you color.
Uh-huh.
And really, we don't even term or call mums hardy mums anymore. You know, more garden mums than anything is what we typically say now.
Okay.
I think that we've lost some of the integrity or the hardiness to some of the mums because we've hybridized various varieties over a number of years to come up with different colors and so forth. And they just don't make the winter.
Right.
I was just
a little joke. You know how we're talking before about people who come up with names for different colors at the paint store. There are people who try to come up with different colors at the florist or at the growers, saying, if I match these two or I cross these two, I'm going to come up with a different color.
I don't know. Not many people think along those lines. Or, you know, only you mixing paints. I know that.
When you said, you know, when we were coming up with different colors.
Yeah, they're hybridizing varieties.
Okay.
But most homeowners don't do stuff like that.
Okay.
You know, it's just you typically go out and you pick up a color that you're interested in, or it might complement your home, the color of your brick, the color of your siding. You just might have a favorite color, you know.
Right.
But, you know, when you talk about the hardiness of mums, you know, they're a tender perennial, so to speak. Now, there's a lot that come into play, and if you really, truly want to find a hardy mum, and if it's even still available, I'm not even able to put my hands on them this year, and those are the mammoth mums, which, you know, they're extremely hardy. However, they have a daisy-like bloom, which to me, that daisy-like bloom, I don't find it all that attractive. Now, that's just from my perspective. And, you know, I've also noticed, too, with the mammoth mums, Todd Baton and I were talking about this a few weeks ago, and I don't think they even grew them this year, but I always used to notice that flies loved them. I don't know why. It was like Amityville Horror.
Wow.
You know, boom, you know, you had all these flies around. But if you truly want to find a hardy mum that can take those cold temperatures, that is one that you might want to find. And if somebody knows this for a fact, please let us know. I understand that they've discontinued that mom.
Okay.
Now, I don't, if that's true or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know that I'm not able to get my hands on those moms this year myself. I don't have a source for those. But there are some things that you can do if you really want to try your best or be successful at wintering over moms. And one of those things that you can do is get them in the ground. The sooner you get them in the ground, the better, because they have the opportunity to get rooted in. Now, if you buy a mom and you leave it on your front porch, you leave it on your stoop, your steps, or in a container, and you don't plant those, and all of a sudden the blooms expire, they start to wither back, they start to, you know, just do their thing. It's not that likely. If you put them in the ground, they're going to get really rooted in that well enough to even make a winter.
Gotcha.
They are shallow rooted for the most part. So what you would more than likely see, because it's not rooted in, as the ground freezes and thaws, it heaves and it brings that root structure, that root system up above the ground just enough to where the crowns freeze out. So that in itself is one of the reasons why mums don't make it. And like I said, the sooner you can get those in the ground and rooted in, it's to your advantage. Along with that, and I found this to be true myself, is, you know, I personally did this. I had greater success when I left the mom intact. And when I say that, I wasn't compelled to do that end of the season garden cleanup, and I got to get everything done before winter sets in and discard it all.
Gotcha.
Let it go.
Right.
You know, and I say this all the time, you know, it's almost like ornamental grasses. It creates winter interest in the landscape beds.
Yeah.
You can, you know, peer outside during the winter months. It might be January, it might be February. You might see several mum plants out there that are totally brown, and you get a little light snowfall or a couple of inches. It creates winter interest. But leaving them intact in place going through the winter months, in addition to mulching them adequately, 2 to 3 inches, you know, I found they wintered over better.
So let me ask you this. What's the rule of thumb when you pick them up from your locally owned, independently operated garden center? How deep do you plant them? And do you put amendments in before you put them in the ground?
I always amend the soil.
Right.
I recommend everybody to amend the soil. The depth, never plant anything too deep. You know, with the exception, I would say, like, for example, if you're planting a clematis, plant it a couple of inches deep in case you get clematis wilt.
Right.
That makes for it bouncing back a little easier. But for most other things, you know, I never plant things deep.
Right.
You plant them at the same level they come out of the pot.
Gotcha. Okay.
And you will also find mums available in plastic pots. You definitely have to take them out of the pot. A lot of people will have mums in fiber pots, which I really like. And that fiber pot somewhat protects that root system. So you can plant it in that fiber pot and it will eventually decay. And I like the fiber pots, or you can take the fiber pot away from the root system and plant the mum. Or if you don't care, let it go. Do whatever. Next, what I used to do, and this is why I like buying from local growers. Most local growers, when they start growing their mums throughout the season, let's just say they might plant 500 this week. Then next week they'll plant another couple hundred.
Gotcha.
And then the following 2 weeks later, they'll plant another couple hundred. So what makes that nice is that things are perpetually coming in a sequence. They all don't bloom at once. I used to buy mums, plant them. Once they bloomed off, I'd chuck them, and I'd put another five out there. Now, of course, we have a garden center. You know, it's a little easier on the pocket when you know what I'm saying?
But, yeah.
You know, when it comes to the fall season, everyone thinks about the mum. And, you know, really, as we're talking about mums, you know, there's a lot of other things that you can plant along with them that are very complementary. And we'll talk about that when we come out of the break.
Yep.
What you might want to add to a container when you're planting up with mums and so forth. And it's going to create a lot of pizzazz right there at the front door.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Need to pause for a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And we have been talking about mums. As a matter of fact, Tony, we got a message on our Facebook page from Jane Bay. A question for you. When planting the mums, should you loosen the roots or leave them intact when putting them in the ground?
Great question. You know, I've been
working with her.
Always look at the root structure, whatever it is that you buy at any garden center or nursery. A lot of times you will also see where some things are fairly root bound, and it could be any type of shrub. It could be any type of tree, as a matter of fact. But, you know, whenever you take a plant out of its container, look at the root structure. If it looks like there's a lot of roots there and are rather tight, sometimes you can score those with a pocket knife. You can just lightly tease those with your fingertips and loosen them up ever so gently.
Right.
You know, don't tear into it and damage it by any means, but you just got to have a little finesse about it and do what you need to do.
Massage it just a little bit.
Yeah, it's like going to the massage parlor.
Yeah. Give it a little loving.
Yeah, a little loving. Just a little, just that right touch. You know, so great question. And you should always do that whenever you plant something. You know, look at that root structure.
Water it in right away.
Absolutely.
Visit the watering table.
And it does not hurt to use a root stimulator or some sort of a starter type of fertilizer when you're planting things. Now, you don't need as much, you know, with mums. They've already been fed for the most part, and they're ready with, you know, they've already set up buds. They're going to come on. They're going to give you the color. Also, on the same token, I don't want you to use too much. Stay away from the green box. You guys know what I'm talking about. Use things that are very mild with a nitrogen ratio, something low. And now, don't use too much because you can burn the root system.
Are mums, I guess, how do I want to put this? It's not regarded as a sun dominant, or, you know, does it need full sun? Is it okay in shade? How are they going to survive in either war?
If you're going to plant them and you're looking to winter those over, if at all possible, all that good stuff, yes, you do want some sun, because if they make it for next year and as they start to develop and come on, you'll need to pinch those back, cut them back a couple of different times throughout the growing season. So therefore, if you're not getting enough sun, at least 6 hours, you may not get that bud production. So, but when you buy them at the nursery or garden center and you're just using them as decorations, the buds are already there.
Right.
So they're going to open up for you. Okay. I mean, even if they're in a little bit of shade, that's fine. So
that's the reason I ask, is because you mentioned about a couple of things that would go well with them when you bring them home if you're going to use them as decoration on the porch. And as you approach the front porch in that little landscape bed just on the right side of our front door, it gets just a little bit of morning sun, and then it's in shade.
Well, you have plenty of light there. You're fine.
Is that enough? Okay.
Yeah, I would probably, you know, you really would not know what to expect unless you actually were able to plant a mum in that spot, it winter over, and you go through a whole growing season with that mum. Okay. That would be the telltale sign as to, do you have enough light or do you not have enough light? You would not know that until you experience that.
Gotcha.
And that's what gardening's all about. And I say this all the time. The sign of a good gardener, do you know what that is?
I do. That you lose a plant.
That someone who has lost a plant. Yeah. Absolutely. Every plant that we plant does not always necessarily make it. I've lost plants. You've lost plants.
Yeah.
It happens. For whatever reason, even if you plant it correctly, and then someone comes back to the garden center, and inevitably, you sold me a bad plant. Well, this is one of my favorite sayings.
Yeah.
And this is not mine. It's Jim Montag.
Oh, I love Jim. Yeah.
You know,
wait a minute. Is this?
This is one of the sayings. If you bring something back to the garden center.
Is it clean enough to use on
the
air?
Yes, no, it is. It is. Do you think it was murder? Or would you think it might have been suicide? You know, that's a great one.
Yeah.
But, you know, we say that jokingly.
Sure.
However, you know, if you lose something, you lose something. And this is what's important about supporting your local garden centers and nurseries, because we are there to help support you. And when we start asking you questions about, you know, let's go back to when you planted it and talk about the situation and the growing conditions, the location where that plant was located. How do you water? How much light was it getting? Did you fertilize? Did you not fertilize? Because, you know, we want you to be successful. And if we don't ask you that kind of information, we can give you that plant and you can go back and do the same thing and have the same result. So, you know, it's sometimes, you know, it's those trials and tribulations that, you know, experience is the best teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so don't be afraid to lose something. Never be afraid to give something a go or a try.
Right.
That I find to be most challenging, and I enjoy doing that.
Right. 749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Great way to stay connected with us. To jump onto our Facebook page, and coming up in just about a half an hour, we're going to post a video. We had our friends from Bluegrass Quality Meats over at our house.
We had a great time.
It was fantastic. It's the football season. It's tailgating season.
Right.
It's even fall riding season for motorcyclists. Are we just having people over for a little cookout as we enjoy these beautiful fall temperatures? Bluegrass Quality Meats is a great selection to make sure you have on your grill. And so we did that. We took a little time. Tony and David and Paul came over to the house, and we did a little grilling, and John, our producer, filmed it, and we're going to post that on our Facebook page coming up at 7:30. And it was fun.
It was fun. And, we also have a special guest from Arlinghouse Heating and Air.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan's going to be joining us around the 8 o'clock hour. And if you need to tune up that furnace or anything before we get into the winter months, or you have any questions, that's a great opportunity to call in and ask Ryan what it is that you need to find out. Also, we still have on our plate the plan of the week.
Yeah.
And what's bugging you.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about Bluegrass Quality Meats, and it's tailgate season and tomorrow's NFL kickoff.
That's exactly right. 749-B105 in and around the house. So look us up and like us on Facebook. But before we kind of got distracted there about a few things that our callers were interested in, you were going to tell me what goes well.
What's complimentary.
Complimentary for the mums.
Absolutely.
Because now's a perfect time to get that beautiful fall color going. There's a pumpkin spice latte available everywhere. And, you know, it's a great time to kind of get in that mood.
Well, especially with the weather, the way that it's been. It's awesome. And, you know, when we take those old, tired window boxes, mm-hmm. containers, plants, pots, whatever,
right.
and jazz them back up with that fall magical motif, that look, you know, we're extending the whole season before we get into the holidays.
Right.
And I love the fall. But talk about some things that are very complimentary to moms. And next week, John, our plant of the week is going to be ornamental peppers, because that's one of my favorites. There are so many varieties now of ornamental peppers that just really pizzazz up a container. They complement mom so well. And, you know, for example, there's a ornamental pepper called Black Pearl.
Okay.
And you can't eat them. You can, I guess, if you want. nothing's going to prohibit you from that. But that Black Pearl, it's a black pepper. And it would accent like a yellow-colored mum.
Okay.
You know, that's just an example. The cabbage, the ornamental cabbage and the ornamental kale, they just really, really come into their own. And the cooler the temperatures get and become, the more vibrant those colors are with the ornamental cabbage and kale. And those of you that have purchased these in the past, you know exactly what I'm saying. As we get cooler, they become more vibrant. So that's another complimentary kind of item with your mom's asters. I love asters.
Aster what?
Aster what you want
for Christmas.
For Christmas or for dinner. You think, you know what? That's why you never made it in the comedian world. That was bad.
I know.
That was good.
It made you laugh.
You're witty. That's what I like about you. You know, asters are great. You'll also find, you know, there's people that are selling various types of celosia, one called dragon's breath.
What's a celosia?
It's a type of plant. It's an annual. It's mm-hmm. got this vivid, deep red color to it, Definitely will highlight containers and so forth. What else am I going to talk about? Mustards, ornamental mustards. Those are becoming, you know, coming into play a lot. You just get that really cool looking foliage color.
Okay. And these are all things you can
buy at your local garden centers and nurseries. They come in various size pots.
That's what I was going to ask, that you could put into some of the window boxes, some of the containers that you have. Maybe those big pots that you have on your patio are starting to show a little wear. Time to go through those and bring them back to life.
And that's why I like going to the local garden centers and nurseries, because when you're looking for mums, when you're looking for asters, when you're looking for cabbage and kale or the mustards or the various ornamental peppers, we carry those in an array of size pots. And like, for example, a 4-inch pot or a 6-inch pot is perfect for a window box. You know, now if you have some larger containers, then, you know, look for like 6- and 8-inch size pots. And even mums will grow mums and have mums for retail and 12-inch pots, which are huge. And, you know, the thing of it is, when you get those mums that are that size, try to water underneath and don't get on top. You know, they can sometimes get really heavy when they start opening up the flowers, and they'll just lay open. Now, some of the growers will stake some of their mums, and hopefully they don't have to. Or they'll put like a real fine green mesh. What are you doing? That's weird. You just took that big hair loop of yours and pulled it up over your head. I was like, what? That's Ernie over there acting goofy. But this green mesh, a lot of the guys will grow their mums up through it, and it keeps everything together and compact and keeps them from flopping over.
So you've got to cut that away?
No. Just leave it alone? Leave it in play. You don't even hardly notice it. And really, if you want to look for a good quality mum, I'm going to point this out as well. You're going to find it at your local garden centers and nurseries, not at the boxes, because when you look at these mums, look for a mum that's got some girth to it, some width to it, not where it's straight up and lanky looking. When you grow for numbers, all those mums, they're never spread out. They're all bunched up, and they grow tall. They're reaching for light. But when they spread out a mum, give it some room, you get that beautiful shape.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Need to pause for a moment. When we come back, we're going to check in with Big Dave from the morning show here at B105, and what else?
We're going to talk about our plant of the week.
Plant of the week.
The Thuja, the Arborvita.
I like the way you talk. We'll be right back. Welcome back, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have our friend Big Dave from Big Dave's Morning Show with Chelsea and Stats.
Big Dave.
On the line. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you?
Dandy, thanks for asking. How about you?
I'm on my way out to the Walk to End Alzheimer's at Voice of America Park for Butler, Warren, and Clinton Counties this morning.
So. Oh, good for you. Always doing good work, aren't you?
Yeah. I was listening in, and you guys were kind of talking about fall, and I had a question I wanted to know from Tony, because I always get my pepper plants from him there at Jackson Florist, and I got the ghost peppers and the Caribbean habaneros and the just standard orange habaneros. I mean, is my growing season done for those, Tony, you think?
Yeah, it's, you still should be getting some on there. You know, it all depends on, you know, are you still seeing blooms?
Not really.
Other than that, no, you're pretty much done for the most part, because we're going to start really cooling down. And peppers do their best when it's really hot. And thank you for the salsa, by the way. Very good. And I will.
Got the ghost peppers. You gave me a ghost pepper plant this year, and they did hot. Really good in this environment. I wasn't, you know, sometimes some peppers do better in this environment than others. Habaneros and the really hot peppers seem to do really well.
They do. I you know, usually, and then all of a sudden they come on at once for the most part. And that's probably what you experienced, what you saw. And if you're not getting still any production or anything on the plant itself, I would just go ahead and lift those up and maybe plant some other things like some fall crops, maybe like lettuce, whatever, spinach, things like that.
try that then. Well, I've got a few of on the ghost pepper plant. I've got a few green ones left and a couple of red ones. I could cut those red ones at any time, but the ones that are green, I've been monitoring them, and they don't seem to really be showing any signs of ripening now. I think they're just going to stay green.
You pick them and let them sit around, they'll change color.
You think so?
Yeah, they usually do.
Okay.
And, you know, if you're not getting production, then that's a telltale sign. You know, hey, things are coming to a head. Go ahead, you know, lift them up. Maybe plant some other things, you know, that's kind of a cold crop type of thing. And go with it from there.
Yeah, well, we got deer that come by. I got to be careful. I planted an okra plant just for fun this year, and the deer have been eating all the okra.
Oh, really? So, you know, that's a good-looking plant, believe it or not.
I know. It's a very nice plant. I'd never done it before. I didn't get a lot of production off the okra, but it was a lot of leaves, and all the leaves are gone now. Those deer, they ate. Last year, they ate a couple of those habanero leaves, and they didn't mess with those anymore because the leaves are hot, too.
Oh, I hear you. Yeah, it's, you know, the deer destroyed my tomato plants this year. I preach and talk about using some of the products. You think I'd take my own advice, but I'm always working. And, deer, I don't know. You can't beat those guys. It's tough.
Ringing the dinner bell. I wanted to tell you real quick today something fun we're going to do is my wife has those window boxes, and she always gets those sweet potato vines from you.
Uh-huh.
You know, for the decorative ones. And usually there's sweet potatoes in those window boxes when you yank them out.
Right.
But they're really hard. One year we tried to make mashed potatoes out of a couple of them that were really big.
Oh, you're killing me. Wait, okay, what happened?
I wanted them to taste good because they, but they didn't. I mean, those things were hard as a rock, but they're really pretty when you pull them out because they're kind of purple.
Yeah, right.
And then we steamed them and boiled them and Matt tried to mash them, and man, it was an undertaking. I mean, I'm talking, there wasn't much difference between it and a rock you find out in the yard. We got it soft enough, and with enough butter, it became edible. But, you know, it's like I said, we wanted it to taste good, but it just didn't taste right.
We had that question a couple weeks ago, didn't we, Ernie?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, I just like, pull those up, discard them, and, you know, and plus, we're usually using, you know, pesticides or various things throughout the growing season sometimes on our plants, and that's why I always encourage people not to try and make things that
Well, you have us do that systemic flush or whatever on them because those beetles get on there and eat holes in all the leaves.
Yeah, they will too, yes.
Yeah.
But
all right, boys, well, I tell you, before I go there, Tony, I need you to get a hold of a Carolina Reaper plant for me.
You got it. That's a hot one. Yep, that's a hot one.
Because everybody, when we did the ghost pepper salsa on the morning show, said, "Hey, you guys, the ghost pepper's hot, but you got to get a Carolina Reaper." And I was like, "Okay, well,
right.
I'll try to grow that next year too."
It's on my radar, Dave. Just for you, as long as I get salsa, and I'll return your jars. Good talking with you.
Good night. Have a great weekend, guys.
All right, you do the same.
He loves his peppers, Ernie. those peppers.
I was just sitting here thinking of, well, if the ghost pepper is painful, why would you want to go to the Carolina Reaper and make it even worse? But, hey, to each their own.
You're right. And do you remember that what did I bring in? It was a rub that one of our customers had made.
Yes. I remember that.
And it had a Carolina Reaper. Remember? You just put a little bit on your
just
tongue.
A little touch. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, you said, try this. Put some on your tongue.
And you did exactly what I said.
Ooh, and lit me up.
You nearly had a heart attack.
I did. It was.
It turned red as that shirt is that you have on, as a matter of fact.
It was instantly painful. 749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We need to pause for a moment when we come back.
Plant of the week. Hang in there with us.
Of the week. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. It's going to be a great day to get to your locally owned, independently operated garden center and then get out and about in your lawn. Gorgeous weather. And we're going to focus now on the information we try to provide for you every week, the plant of the week. What do you got for us this week?
It's the Arborvita.
Arborvita.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this the other day when I was out, you know, out in Oregon, I was visiting a couple different nurseries, and there's various, just the evergreens out there are awesome, and you can just go on and on. Mm-hmm. But I got to thinking about, something caught my attention out there, and it was an arborvitae that, it's called Mr. Bowling Ball.
Mr. Bowling
but
Ball.
We'll get the Mr. Bowling Ball, but I saw Mr. Bowling Ball done up in a pyramidal shape, and it was awesome looking, and I would have never thought to do that, because we're always wanting it to be perfectly round. But anyway, the arborvitae seems like it's I don't know, in recent years, or people are like, ooh, I don't want that. But I'm here to tell you, wait a minute, time out. You know, we got to give this plant more merit than what we do. You know, and that's just my opinion. Because there's so many different applications that you can use various types of arborvitae for. You know, they're great as an accent plant. Most importantly, most people that come into the garden center, they're like, Tony, I like my neighbors, but. Yeah, but what? Wait a minute. What's that but part? We always want a little bit of privacy. So, you know, that's where the arborvitae can come into play and provide some screening, too. So there's various types of arborvitae that will give us a little bit of screening, a little bit of privacy, and we're going to talk about those. You can use them in a mass planting along a border, however you desire to do this. So really, it's a great shrub to have. It's not that bad. Mm-hmm. And I thought about the arborvitae because it's going to lead into our other segment, what's bugging you, and keep that in mind, too, because we'll talk about that next.
Okay.
But when we talk about the arborvitae, one that we're most common, or that we commonly see, is an upright variety called Emerald. Smerg is another name. And it will typically get about 10 to 15 feet in height and about a 3 to 4 foot width. And those are the ones that you typically see planted rather close together, and they'll give you that screening effect.
Okay.
Are you familiar with what I'm talking about, Ernie?
Yeah.
You've seen it. If you were to cruise up Highland Pike over there in northern Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
you know, that auto salvage place.
Right.
There's a
D&J, I think it's called.
No, that's on Kyle's Lane.
Okay.
You're close, though. You're down another half a mile.
Oh, I got you.
You with me?
Ratterman's.
Yes. So you'll see, you know, those are arborvitae, and that's the type that we're talking about. And, you know, that's the Emerald. They get about 10 to 15 foot in height and a 3 to 4 foot width. And it provides great screening. And another one that I like, it's a little bit narrower, and it's one that you really need to look for because of its narrowness, and it gives you that application. If you have an area where you have space constraints and you want, you know, that type of a structure, then DeGroote's Spire, that is DeGroote's, DeGroote's Spire. This is one that gets about 10 to 15 foot in height, and it's a little narrower than Emerald. It's about a 2 foot width. So you get the same height, a little bit of narrowness there, and it has, you know, it too can come into play, Ernie, when we talk about giving you a little bit of that privacy and screening. Now, another one of my favorites doesn't get quite as tall.
Uh-huh.
And it's a sport off of one called Rheingold, and that is one called Fire Chief. I love this arborvitae. You talk about it has this yellow hue in it at the very tip with a red tinge. Very, very attractive in the landscape. Gets about 2 to 3 foot in height and about that in width, and it really creates a lot of interest in the landscape. I will tell you this, it does not take long. If you don't put this out in sun, you'll lose the color quickly. It will revert back to a green, but if you get it back out into the sun, it'll take on that yellow tinge with that red color at the tips, and it happens rather quickly, believe it or not. I had one pulled aside for a customer, had it in our one greenhouse, waiting for them to pick it up. They didn't come for a week or so, and you could see it going to green.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But as soon as I took it outside, it wasn't there long after.
Came right back to life.
Came right back. Gave you that beautiful, beautiful color.
Mm-hmm.
But that's Fire Chief. Look for that particular arborvitae. And like I said, it's a, you know, it gets around a 3 foot range, give or take. Same with width. very, very attractive in the landscape. Mm-hmm. Now, another one that I like, Mr. Bowling Ball.
Mr. Bowling Ball.
I remember when Mr. Bowling Ball came out, it was supposed to stay nice and compact and tight, and it does, and it's perfectly round, and it holds that shape.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets a little bigger than what I think we were led to believe initially. A friend of mine bought one. He bought a couple of them from us a couple years ago, and it got pretty close to 4 feet.
Right.
It was about 4x4. It wasn't that little bowling ball look that everyone was saying, this is what it's going to be. And that leads me to say this real quick. When we see the tags, when we read the tags, and you could read things online, you could hear me talk about it or someone else, various heights are always different with plants, no matter where you hear it from or who talks about it. Keep this in mind. Things do not quit growing until the day they die. So when we give you those average heights and average widths, that's exactly it. That's over a period of time and ideal growing conditions and situations. That just gives us an idea what we can expect. But I want to put some emphasis on this. It doesn't quit growing until the day it dies. It could get a little bit taller, just like I was talking about Mr. Bowling Ball.
Right.
So keep that in mind. And Mr. Bowling Ball, when I saw it out in Oregon, done up in a pyramidal shape, very, very attractive. I liked it in that look versus it just being rounded.
Sure, sure.
So a great plant, to say the least. Another one real quick is the Western Arborvitae. And there's two that I want to really touch on real quick. One is Green Giant, and the other one is Spring Grove. Both of them are going to get around a 30-foot range in height, give or take. And pretty much, 10 to 15 foot in width.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, beautiful specimens. Spring Grove, hence the name, is a Cincinnati, Ohio selection from Spring Grove Cemetery. Not always the easiest to find, but it got a lot of notoriety going through the winters back in the 70s.
Wow.
It held its composure. It held its color. It made those cold temperatures. And therefore, we got this beautiful selection over there in Spring Grove Cemetery, and it's a Western Arborvitae, second to none. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. This also gives you that screening, that privacy look,
mm-hmm.
along with Green Giant. That is one you find often, too, at your local garden centers and nurseries. So when you come into the garden center and you say, hey, I'm looking for some ornamental grasses. I need some height. I need to screen off my neighbors, although I like them. Think about some of these arborvitaes. The Green Giant, it can put on, once it's rooted in, anywhere from a foot to 3 foot of growth in a season.
Wow.
That's quick growth.
That is.
And you talk about a beautiful specimen. And even more importantly, we know that, like, we talk about the arborvitae, like the Emerald, Smaragd, and De Groot, Spire.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, deer are an issue with those, but not the Western arborvitae. So you're going to have a beautiful specimen, great screening, and it very deer resistant. So look for these at your local garden centers and nurseries, especially if you're looking for a little bit of privacy. The arborvitae is a great plant. Don't be discouraged or say, nah, I don't want one of those, or I've had one before. If you take care of those, you water them when it's necessary, make sure they don't sit in a place that's too wet throughout the winter months,
mm-hmm.
mulch them appropriately, they'll be good to you. Just keep an eye on those, which leads us into our next segment, which is what's bugging you.
We'll do that when we come back.
You got it.
In and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Need to pause for a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And the question at the moment is,
what's bugging you?
What is bugging you?
Yeah, really, it's bagworm activity.
Bagworm?
Bagworm. We've had a lot of bagworm activity this year.
Yeah.
And,
tell me a little bit about the bagworm.
The bagworm. It's a caterpillar. And typically when you see bagworms or you have issues with bagworms, at first glance, you might look over at one of your evergreens and see these little bags hanging.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think, ah, it's like a little pine cone.
Right.
But really, it's not.
You know, looks like a little seedling.
Take a very close look at those kind of things. It's a caterpillar that kind of hangs out in a bag that just hangs on the bottom, you know, the bottom side of the branch.
Oof.
And they can be anywhere from an inch and a half to about 2 inches in length. And these guys, these bagworm dudes, they love junipers. Arborvitae. We're talking about arborvitae, which, you know, we're talking about the green giant and the spring grove, which you don't see bagworm issues on those as much as you might some others. They're pretty much resistant to that, which makes them even more so desirable.
Right.
But bagworms love junipers. You know, you might even find them on the arborvitae, spruces, pines, cedars. It doesn't just stop there. 1 year I had bagworms on my Japanese maple.
Really?
Yes.
So they can go to other things.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And, you know, primarily you see them around evergreens for the most part. Blue spruces, you'll see those. They're hanging out on the globosas, the standard forms, you know, the shrub form, low grafts. But, you know, bagworm activity has been really, really bad. And right now, I will tell you this, do not let somebody sell you a spray and think you're going to kill these guys hanging out on your shrubs or trees.
I was just about to ask you, how do you combat these things?
Well, right now, the best combat or the best defense is to pick them off.
Okay.
Especially, hopefully you can reach up that high.
Yeah, how far up do they go?
However tall your tree might be. If you might have a blue spruce that's 15, 20 feet.
Right.
It's not going to be very easy to pick them off of.
No.
However, if you have something that's a little shorter or lower in stature, don't buy a spray. Save yourself some money and just pick them off. Now, I'm going to tell you why. If someone's trying to sell you a spray for those right now, that little bag, that's their home.
Mm-hmm.
That protects them. And pretty soon, the female, she's going to be leaving the bag.
Okay.
And that's when these bags winter over. This is the life cycle. Well, actually, the males right now are kind of looking for them, too.
Yeah.
All right. But typically, the bagworms will pass through the winter holding eggs only.
Okay.
And there can be 300 or more eggs in one of those bags. And next year, they'll hatch, usually mid-May, the late May. And a tiny larva, they crawl out, and they start just feasting on stuff. I mean, they'll eat for weeks, okay? And they're starting to, you know, they're starting to grow, go through the instar stages. You know, they will strip an evergreen quickly. At that point, you know, when they're small, and if you look on our Facebook page, this is a great example. If you look at the very last photograph that I have, that is a bagworm in the instar stage, what we call the dunce cap stage. Yeah. So it looks like an ice cream cone.
Yeah.
Kind of. Okay. At that point in time, that's when they're most vulnerable with an insecticide.
Gotcha.
Okay. Right now, they're not. So if someone sells you something to kill a bagworm, it's not going to happen. You're wasting your money.
Selling you a bill of goods.
That's right. It's snake oil at that point in time. It's not going to work. But when they're in that dunce cap stage, or the bags are still relatively small in size where they're just putting them together, you can spray, and you can spray effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done it before. The sprays are very, very effective if you time it right. And again, that timing is late May, early June. That's when you start seeing that small instar larva activity stage. And like I said, when they're in that dunce cap stage, that's where it is. There's another photograph in here. Curtis Young from the Ohio State University Extension. I used a couple of his photographs. You could see the female attached to the pine twig, and they'll just devour these things.
Yeah, it was.
It's incredible. That photograph, Curtis Young, you did an awesome job. That's one heck of a close-up shot.
Sure.
And this just gives you the representation of what kind of damage a bagworm can do to your evergreens. And if they go unchecked for a couple of seasons, you're going to be calling somebody in to remove a shrub or remove a tree when you could have just taken matters into your own hands. Remember that? People's
Yes.
Court?
That's right.
What was that? Doug Luella? Yes, don't take matters into your own hands. Take them to court. No, we want you to take matters into your own hands.
Right.
So you really, you know, I say this often. When you mow once a week, if you're one of those guys that mows twice a week, pay attention to your shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell you what's going on. Pay attention to your turf. Pay attention to your trees. And the more attention that you give your plants in the landscape, they'll be happier, healthier plants because you can ward these things off.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm telling you, the bagworm, it's incredible the damage it can do. And if you really want to control them successfully, like I said, it's when they're in the instar stage, rather young, they're in that dunce cap stage. And there's a couple of different products out there that you can pick up on the shelf at your local garden centers and nurseries that's very, very effective. What I used was a product called Spinosad. And Fertiloom makes it. It's a boar, bagworm, leaf miner, and tent caterpillar spray. And it's Spinosad, very, very effective. Or you can find it under the Bonide name, Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew. One of the two, as long as you're using Spinosad. Also BT, which is a biological way to get rid of them. High yields Thuricide, great product. You could also use 7, anything that has carbaryl in it, or permethrin, 38 plus, which I love from High Yield.
Yeah.
If you have insect issues, spray that around your house outside only. You'll call me up and say, Tony, that's some good stuff, 38 plus. But those items that I just mentioned will take care of your bagworm issues. But it's all about timing.
Mm-hmm.
We say it all the time. If you want to grow a nice lawn, you got to do it in September,
mm-hmm.
early October.
Right.
It's timing. If you want to be a good baseball player, it's all about timing. If you're a good hitter, right?
Right.
If you're a Joey Votto, you got to have good timing. The same with the bagworm. So get out to your local garden centers and nurseries. If you're having issues with bagworms right now, I want you to pick them off if you can reach up that high. And next year, wait till they hatch. And then go at it with a spray.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Our video with our friends from Bluegrass Quality Meats is up on our Facebook page. Make sure you take a few minutes and check that out. It was an awful lot of fun. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Ryan Houlihan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air is going to be joining us. We need to pause for a moment, and we'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And we had a little bit of fun a couple of weeks ago. Paul and David from Bluegrass Quality Meats and Tony came by the house. And, you know, it is football season, officially kicked off at the NFL on Thursday. UC has already played, had their first game. And high school football is a couple of weeks into it now. And to prep you for tailgating and making sure that you have everything supplied for your family gatherings or just a couple of buddies coming over, Bluegrass Quality Meats brought the house. So
David Cagley and Paul Rice, they uh-huh. brought it. Man, there's a lot of food there.
Yes, there was, and it was all delicious. So jump onto our In and Around the House Facebook page. We spent a little time at the grill. Tony spent most of the time talking, and then David and Paul and I did all the work.
Which I do. That's what I do best. Thank you.
But take the time to jump onto our Facebook page. We had a great little video of the moments there. The food was delicious. The recipes were great, and everybody explains how they cooked and what they cooked. And when you get a chance to get ready for your tailgate party, make sure you stock up with Bluegrass Quality Meats. It was a lot of fun. And I even got a chance to make Paul laugh when you said something about the blueberries having all the antioxidants. And for some reason or other, I said, and that's no accident. And it cracked him up. Well, a lot of fun.
That's all. I'm just trying to help you get rid of those toxins, Ernie. It's all about getting rid of the toxins, yeah. The bad stuff that's in us. Yeah, blueberries are supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
However many you have to eat, I don't know.
Tony, we have Jason on the line from Milford. He has a new home. Jason, do you have us on speaker?
Yeah.
Can you take us off the speaker? It makes it a little hard to hear you.
Hard time hearing you. I appreciate it.
He has a new home, and seed has been down and has a couple of questions about that.
Go ahead,
Jason.
Yeah, my question is basically, I'm looking at probably the home being built, and we'll be moving in probably in November, but kind of the deal is I know they're just going to come in, do some grade work, some light topsoil, contractor grade seed on the ground, throw straw on it, tip their hat, and they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
What I want come next spring, obviously, is a beautiful green plush yard. I guess what my question is though that there is straw on the ground, can I add fertilizer? Can I add extra seed to it, a better quality type of thing?
Well, so everything's in play right now with the seed and the straw, correct?
Well, yeah, what will happen is, you know, they'll have to do the grade work and stuff like that. And geographically speaking, we're moving from the west side of town to the east side of town.
Okay.
They're not going to call me and say, hey, we're going to do this today. And I can
right,
get out
I got
there
it.
With a, you know, nice, that's what I want on it. But
right, right. Know. Well, you know, just because, you know, I hear this often, too. People say, hey, they're just using a builder's grade. A lot of times, they're using a good blend, too. So don't sell yourself short and think that you're getting the cheapest of the cheap. That's not always the case. I can tell you this, that what's in my lawn is still pretty much what was there when we built our home back in the early 90s. But, you know, and I've done some things along the way with various types of tall fescues. And one in particular is Fine Lawn Elite, which is now Fine Lawn H2O. Back in the day when I was younger, it was Fine Lawn 5GL, you know, which is a great tall fescue. You know, get with your builder and find out what are they using. And if you can, by any means, maybe say, hey, suggest something you might be interested in. But find out what it is that they're using first so you know. And especially from this point forth, if you ever want to keep things similar, you know, it's going to help you do so.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just figure starting with a new canvas, it'd be nice to get a nice, rich, green grass. I thought possibly the fertilizer has a lot to do with that.
It does. It does.
So, well, that's what I need. I appreciate it, guys. You have a good day, okay?
You too.
All right, thanks.
You know, Jason brought up a good thing. I want to say this real quick.
Yes.
You know, in this particular situation, we have that the ground is totally bare. And he's working with a builder, obviously. But what's most important, and I can't say this enough, is to use a starter fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this reason, and for this reason only, is because it has a higher amount of phosphorus in it. It's that middle number. And we have plenty of phosphorus in the soil, but it's not releasing. So that's why when we put down grass seed, especially on a newly sown lawn, that phosphorus in the seed starter fertilizer is so, so important with that turf. Once it germinates, once that seed germinates and that turf starts to build and you know, develop, the phosphorus is helping that root system more than you'll ever, ever imagine. And that's why that comes into play and is so important to get that turf off to the right start. And put down the seed starter fertilizer first before you sow the grass seed. Especially if you're doing a large area, Ernie.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you put the seed down and then you get out there and walk on it and start throwing the starter fertilizer down, you could very easily displace some of that seed as you're out there walking on it. So do it in the reverse order. The fertilizer first, than the seed.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We need to pause for a moment. When we come back, we got to talk a little bit about that fertilizer. We'll be right back. Welcome back, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And our friend Ryan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air joined us, and I know his mom and dad really well, and I've known him for a long time, and I can't think of what the name of this game is, but I sent you a message last night, you know, and you had posted, I guess that was Christmas last year?
It was, yeah. Family game night.
Of that game where you put that dental piece in your mouth and try to say something, and I must have watched it 5 or 6 times. Both your mom and dad are very, very funny. But thanks for coming in and joining us again. And Tony, before we get to Ryan, there was something you wanted to point out about fertilizer.
Real quick. I just want to, you know, with the weather, the way that what we're going to see from Irma, maybe Tuesday, Wednesday, a little bit of rain. I just want to put the bug in your ear. It's going to be a great weekend to get out to your local garden centers and nurseries, pick up the Lawn Food Plus Iron, and put down that first fall application of fertilizer for, on your turf. And hopefully this rain comes right behind it, and it's going to water it in well, and you're going to see that beautiful, beautiful, quick green up in your lawn. And this is the best time to get into the Fertiloom 3-Step program.
Yep.
And thanks for the reminder there.
Sure. But welcome, and so, you know, I guess fall has arrived already. Have you had people turn their furnaces on and nothing happened yet?
We have had one call come in. Yeah, it was a lady that she wanted it to be about 78 in the home, and it was like 75, and her furnace wouldn't come on. So we've had one no heat call.
Come on,
so
put some socks on. Put on a sweatshirt.
So, yeah, I mean, you can feel it in the air this morning. That's
you
for sure.
You can. And it sort of tumbled into something really quickly. You went from August, where people are worried about their air conditioners, to suddenly fall in at the first week of September. And, you know, people expect that instant gratification from their largest unit in their house.
You got it. Yeah, you know, people are always surprised when we call in August. You know, the people who are on our maintenance plan, we try and reach out to them first, give them first priority, and we're trying to get them scheduled for September, and they're like, I'm not ready to think about that yet. Can you call me back in a month or so? It's like, it's going to creep up on you fast.
That's a great reminder. Tell us a little bit about that plan.
Yeah, so our maintenance plan, a couple different ways you can do it. You can prepay it for the entire year. You can do it monthly. Very affordable, $19.95 a month, and it gets your heating and cooling checks covered, and you get some additional services and discounts on everything that we do.
That's fantastic. Contact information quickly?
Yeah, it's you can reach us at 859-727-9000. You can also get on our Facebook page, and then arlinghouseair.com as well.
Well, Tony was ribbing you just a little bit. You have been our go-to guy. Normally, you know, we had Brian Arlinghouse in here for the first couple of days, and now he's drifting along the Mississippi River or something. What's going on there?
He's back. Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah,
okay.
He is back. He went on a little adventure with a friend of his. They were trying to break a world record. Already have broke the world record for longest distance traveled in a John boat. So he took the dog and hopped in for 200-300 miles, and he's back. So, yeah.
Ernie, I have an idea how you can break that record.
How?
We can just pull a John boat across the country and put you in the back. that would break the distance record, right? Or did it have to be on water? It
must be on water. There must be a little something there. But thanks for thinking of me.
Absolutely.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Ryan Houlihan is with us from Arlinghouse Heating and Air. Tell us a couple of things quickly about what homeowners should be thinking about right now. I mean, we've had overnight lows in the 40s already.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing is, you know, for me personally, the thing that I'm thinking about right now is my filter change. Mm-hmm. So I'm coming around. It happens twice a year for me. Other people have to change it a lot more often than that.
Right.
But getting ready to get the furnace ready, get it cleaned, get the filter clean, all that good stuff. So getting ready for fall.
Speaking of the filters, you know, we've been doing an awful lot of construction around our house. Tell us how important that is to make sure that that's changed.
Absolutely. So, you know, your heating and air system, I mean, it's the vessel that moves all the air in the home. So whether that's, you know, hot air, cold air, whatever we're doing, we need to move air through it efficiently. And that coincidentally is the key to efficiency. So longevity on mechanics, all that good stuff. If you clog up that air filter and your furnace can't breathe or your air conditioner can't breathe, then it's going to cause damage. So
is there a standard of how much air should be moving through your house? How do you measure that? Or I guess it depends on the square footage of the house, but how do you judge that?
That's a great question. So that's actually something that our licensed technicians can test for. So the ductwork is designed and rated to move a certain amount of air throughout the home. So it's engineered that way. And then we can actually verify, is it, you know, is it enough? Was it done properly?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, well, the most common thing is we find a lack of return air in the home. So the air that's being pulled back to get heated or cooled, more often than not, they undersize that. So we identify those issues.
I hate to sound like the simpleton that I am, but I was always confused by that. The vent and the cold air return. Explain that just a little bit for someone who may also be confused by that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, your heating and cooling system, it's got to push air through the home and it's got to pull it back. So we push that out through registers and vents, usually located in the floor or on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the cold air return is what it's most commonly known as. But nowadays it's just the return. So in older homes, you'll find those return vents that are on the floor, big open grates. And then in newer constructed homes, it's going to be higher on the wall towards the ceiling. And that's where we're pulling air in. And you can easily identify those not only by putting your hand on it, but return grills, you can't open and close, and supplies, you can. So,
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, because
would there be a reason to put an open and close on a return?
No.
Or would you not want to do that?
You would definitely not want to do that. In some cases, some people in two-story homes, because usually there's a temperature difference, right? We'll try to maybe cut off a little bit of the return on the first floor to try and draw a little bit more air from up top.
That makes sense.
In the summertime.
Well, that was one of the key things that you guys did for us when you put in our new system, and it made the biggest difference. Our bedroom was always the warmest place in the home and the coldest. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had the cathedral ceiling. And when you tied in a new return vent, because we didn't have one existing in our bedroom, to the one that was in the hallway, it made all the difference in the world. So do they put those in? Would you recommend one return vent upstairs, or are they doing those now in separate rooms?
Man, it really, really just depends. I mean, the most ideal situation for me, I love when I walk into a house that has a return in every single bedroom because that gives me a lot to work with. But, you know, in my house, you know, certain builders don't do that. So I only have two main returns, one in the upstairs hallway and one downstairs in the dining room. And those are the only, they're centralized. In that application, we really need to make sure that we're not closing doors, like, around the house, or making sure that the bottoms of the doors are actually cut up a little bit,
right,
so that you can draw air from underneath the door. So.
If you were to build a new home, Ryan, would you put, or would you suggest to someone who's doing so, to put returns in all the bedrooms upstairs?
If you would like to be comfortable in the summertime, yes, absolutely. If it was my house, I would want one in every single bedroom, ideally.
And then one centralized return downstairs would be adequate.
It would be adequate.
For the most part.
As long as it was all sized properly.
Right.
You know, my house is comfortable, even though I have central, you know, returns upstairs and downstairs. So it's still comfortable. It's just, in especially two-story homes, larger applications, if I was building it from scratch, heck yeah. I want a return in my room.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We're talking with Ryan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air. You can get to their site, arlinghouseair.com, and also check out their Facebook page. We're going to come back and talk with him some more. We also have Stan and Rick on the line who have a couple of plant questions for you, Tony. We'll get to them as soon as we come back from the break. In and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. And we have Ryan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air in with us. We need to pause for a moment. We have Stan on the line from Marymount, and he's got a question for you. Tony's dealing with some chickweed. What's going on, Stan?
I have chickweeds, and normally I've never had these, and this year they've really gotten really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, is there something I can control those with? I also have these like little purple little flowers that seem to be taking over my yard, my lawn in the rear.
The purple flowers, are they in bloom now? Or
no,
was that spring blooming?
That was spring blooming.
Okay, okay. Probably a couple things. One thing with chickweed, it's a winter annual weed, meaning that the chickweed that was able to go into the bloom cycle throughout the season, it's drop seed. And that will germinate late in the fall, sometime in the fall season. and it hangs around, and all of a sudden we see this burst of energy, a burst of growth in the spring, and that's one of our winter annual weeds. If you were to use a pre-emergent, you would knock a lot of that out and keep that from happening.
Okay.
So I don't know what you're doing. Is this in the lawn or is this in your landscape beds?
It's in my lawn.
Yeah. Are you on any type of a program, or do you do any fertilization or any treating your lawn yourself?
I do it myself. I usually do the 3-step program.
Okay.
And my front lawn is beautiful, gorgeous.
Okay.
And I don't put all the care in my rear lawn like I should. I think right. I need to do more of that.
Yeah. Are you as the backyard? Is it somewhat wooded?
No, it's not. It's,
no. Okay.
It's just all green.
You have any open fields around you, or are there other homes close by?
There's another home close by.
Okay.
But it's my yard is completely fenced all the way around.
Okay. Well, put a little bit more emphasis on the back. And something else that comes into play here, too. And, you know, you're doing a 3-step program, and obviously in the month of March, maybe early April, you're using the All Seasons 2 bag from Fertiloom that has the pre-emergent in it.
Okay, yes.
Now, that will give us a really solid 5 months protection. But I want you to look at this on a graphical, you know, like from a graphing kind of standpoint. When you put that down at the beginning, let's say you put it down April 1st.
Okay.
Okay, and you get 5 months. So that's when your protection is at its best. And we're really going after and preventing, for the most part, crabgrass. And that's what most people are trying to prevent in their lawns with the first step, amongst other things as well. But as we progress, we get into May, then we get into June, then we get into July, August, September. That effectiveness starts to decline ever so slightly as we progress throughout the summer months.
Okay.
And a lot of, you know, what else comes into play as well is how often you water or how much rain we get throughout the course of a season. And all that comes into play, and it also reduces the effectiveness in the long run with the pre-emergent. So if you come back in the latter part of summer and put down Dimension in your lawn, that's going to give you an added 4 months protection, and that will help keep those winter weeds from germinating in the turf.
Okay.
So what you're doing, you're just kind of essentially aiding or giving it a little bit more oomph to get you through the fall months.
Get through the fall. Okay.
Exactly. Now, the only caveat here, that the only problem is that you can't sow grass seed if you do that a little bit later in the season.
Okay.
But try that approach. Use a selective herbicide to get rid of what's there. Weed-free zone is great, and you can use it in the cooler temperatures like what we've been having now and go after it this fall.
Okay, I have weed-free zone now because I usually get that from Feathers because I go to Feathers.
Okay, perfect.
And let us know how it goes.
Okay.
All right.
I sure will.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
749-B105, in and around the house. Tony, we have Rick on the line from Goshen, wants to transplant his gardenias. Hey, Rick, how many do you have?
How y'all doing?
All good. Right. How many do you have?
Okay, I've got two beautiful plants that I bought this year.
Mm-hmm.
And the advice you gave me was good luck. A lot of work.
Yes.
But really, the plants took care of themselves. I just watched them and read what they was doing. They yellowed on the leaves. And finally, with a little bit of a liquid Miracle-Gro, they're doing fine.
Okay.
Beautiful white buds. Flowering, smell beautiful. So what I'm getting ready to do, with your advice, is I want to take and replant them into planters for the inside of the house to winter them over.
Okay.
So I'd like that advice. And since you have them HVAC fellows, when you're ready, I'd like to ask them a question.
Okay. Real quick, on transplanting, I don't know what size pots that your gardenias are in now.
They're good size, about 2 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet deep.
That's a pretty good sized pot.
Yeah,
you know, if you've already put the, are they in those pots now?
Yes, they are. Okay. Well, I made them out of some raw cedar I had on the land.
That should be adequate. I wouldn't even transplant them.
Okay.
That should be adequate right now to at least get you through a season or two. If you were going from one pot to the next, I mean, that's big enough. That's going to be heavy enough for you to move anyway.
Oh, I got it on wheels.
Yeah. Well, there you go. But all I would do is when you bring those inside, before you do so, I would pick up a couple of systemic types of insecticidal products to put on the surface of the soil long enough, well enough before you bring those in. So it's a systemic, and you're going to protect yourself from getting insects and bringing them, introducing them to the inside of the home.
Now, I don't know that fancy word.
Well,
but here's what I used was seven.
Seven?
The white flies, right, and the aphids.
That's a topical.
Okay.
If you use a systemic, it's going to give you longer protection. The systemic products, when you hear that term, works in such a way it gets into the plant via its root structure. It's taken up into the plant, and it's almost like you or I getting a vaccination. Okay. It will protect it for however long or however strong that product is. Sometimes up to 3 months, you know, sometimes up to 30 days.
Give me some a name of something.
Bonide makes a great systemic product.
One more time.
Bonide. B-O-N-I-D-E. It's a granular product you can put on top.
Okay.
That works well. And do that before you bring any of your plants indoors. And I always encourage people to do that in the fall months. If not, a lot of times you can introduce some insects to the inside.
I gotcha. Now, one thing I had noticed is I had real nice buds, but it wasn't blooming. And I realized that they weren't getting the right amount of sun.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved them over to where they're getting this early fall sun. Now they're wanting to open up real nicely.
There you go. It's all about light.
Oh, yeah. Now, during the winter months, they don't have the exposure to the sun the way the house is laid out. But, and they'll be in the living room. They'll get indirect light from, say, sun up to, who knows, maybe mm-hmm. 11. Is that going to be adequate for them?
Well, it's not ideal, but it's all you have to work with. And because, unfortunately, they're not hardy. So when you bring that inside, it's going to behave totally different. You'll back off your watering a little bit. You're going to see some leaf yellowing. You'll see leaf dropping. You'll be questioning yourself, like, why did I do this? But hopefully you go through the whole winter months, you know, through the whole period where you can sustain it well enough to get it back outside and get it acclimated next spring and summer, and it will bounce back readily, easy, nice. Now,
could I put them in the ground and leave them out for the winter next year, or are they an indoor outdoor?
Well, you can, but they will not survive the winter outside.
Okay, that's I'll work with them.
Rick, what's your question for Ryan from Arling House? You said
right.
He had HVAC.
Ryan, thank you. Single story house, old farmhouse.
Okay.
Got one cold air return.
Mm-hmm.
We heat a lot with wood here.
Okay.
Don't have a problem with that. Got a lot of insulation pumped in this place.
Okay.
Never paid any attention to it, but somebody had taken and put foam over top of the roof vents that are on the side walls. They're not, it's not the type that are on the ridge.
Mm-hmm.
I took that out here just this past week.
Okay.
Why is it important to have cold air access into your attic during the winter months?
So is this outside air that's being ventilated into the roof?
Well, it's a well-insulated roof,
mm-hmm.
and it has three vents that let cold air in and out.
Right. So that's, and that's, you do need that. That is good ventilation, you know, for the attic. So that's definitely going to be separate air from the air that's inside.
Yeah.
Return versus, you know, pulling air in from outside and ventilating the roof. I mean, it is going to be important for the efficiency, and you don't want to trap moisture. Ventilation is definitely key.
Is about the moisture that you would have cold air coming into your attic area during the winter?
That's correct. So, yeah, you would definitely want, you know, that a good ventilation in the roof is definitely important.
Okay. It just seems odd that you, I mean, I asked the question, so I yield to your knowledge
mm-hmm.
that you would have cold air in the open space in the attic after putting so much insulation into it.
Right. You know, so the insulation is going to be your barrier to keep energy in that heat in the home. So just adequately ventilating the actual roof is just going to be good for moisture. So good to prevent it.
Because wet insulation is useless. mold, all that other bad stuff.
Right.
Okay. Wealth of information, fellas.
All right.
Really appreciate you out here.
Thanks, Rick.
Yep, bye.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie. We have Ryan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air for a moment with us, and we have to pause for a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie. We have our friend Ryan Houlihan in from Arlinghouse Heating and Air, and that was a pretty interesting question from him about, you know, why is it important to have fresh airflow through the attic of your house?
Yep, absolutely.
I have to be honest, I kind of questioned that myself, because you would think that if you stopped airflow from going up there, that you'd keep the rest of the house warm, but that's not the case.
You know, it's cause and effect, right? So, you know, you do one thing and it could have some repercussions. How bad those things are, you know, you never know. So,
yeah.
But the moisture definitely would build up in that. So,
speaking of moisture, let's talk a little bit about humidity, because now, you know, people are going to be closing up the windows at night, and then as cooler temperatures move in, that something that's always surprised me is that initial shock that you don't expect, you know, when you go to shake somebody's hand and they're in your house or something, or reach for a light switch and bam.
Absolutely. Yeah. Static electricity is one of the most common, identifiable reasons why maybe your house doesn't have enough moisture in it. And, you know, a common thing that most people believe is that the furnace dries out the air. Which is not true. It's just that the air outside is getting colder, and colder air can't hold as much moisture as warm air. So in the winter months, when it gets really cold out, that water leaves the air and it gets sucked out of the house, mm-hmm. basically. And interesting fact, the average 2,500 square foot house weighs 10,000 pounds less in the winter than it does in the summer.
Wow.
Because of all the moisture that leaves the house.
You know, that bears repeating. Repeat that again about how, because that's a common, I guess, myth. I always thought that the furnace dried out the air, you know?
Yep. Very, very common thought, but not true.
So what are you thinking, Ernie? You got a way to drop weight here?
It was just one of those things where I just have always heard that.
Yep.
You know, and that's, I guess, how that misinformation spreads, is that, it's dry air because the furnace is running all the time.
Well, everything seeks equilibrium, right? This is physics,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, I didn't dig that one.
I don't get it. Yeah, I already get some mixed up with that kind of stuff.
I had trouble with gazendas.
What goes into
3 gazinda 9?
You know, Ryan, I have a question.
Absolutely.
Explain to us, are there any beneficial differences purchasing or installing an electric heat pump type of unit for your heating purposes versus natural gas?
You know, I would say that the most the best setup, so if I had my pick of the litter, mm-hmm. And I was designing my own system, I would like to have a natural gas furnace with a heat pump, all right? And so basically the outdoor unit would serve, you know, for heating down to a certain temperature.
Right.
And I would be using electric, and then I would have the gas furnace to boot, so when it got colder, down in the 30s, I would heat with natural gas. It's a lot warmer heat. Now, there are some great advancements with heat pumps now. So for all those you people out there that have an electric furnace, or are considering buying a house that has electric, in the past, heat pumps, they just didn't put out very cold air. Or I'm sorry, warm air in the wintertime. But nowadays, they put out over 100 degrees out of the vents. So they're very efficient now. So, but the answer to your question is, ideally, I would want a heat pump in combination with a gas furnace. We call that a Prius, right? Electric when we can, and gas when we have to.
Oh, I like that. That's pretty, being sustainable, more fuel efficient, no doubt about it. Do you get the longevity today out of the heat pump versus what you would say 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I mean,
is it better constructed, better made? Have we broken those barriers? Because I remember building years ago, and everybody would tell me, pay the additional amount of money for the gas line and run it to your house. Mm-hmm. If it's there, run it to your house.
Yeah. We definitely like our fossil fuels.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the answer is yes. They are lasting longer, but that's the big kicker is, you know, is it properly sized? Is it properly installed? And certainly, just like, you know, buying a car, there are some cars that are maybe better constructed than others. Mm-hmm. And so paying a little bit more, well, the old saying, you get what you pay for, right?
Yeah, right.
And the same rule applies to heating and air equipment. So
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We need to pause for a moment. We have Ryan Houlihan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air with us. When we come back, Ryan, we have Marianne on the line from Covedale's got an AC question for you.
Okay.
We need to pause. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have Ryan Houlihan with us from Arlinghouse Heating and Air. You can get to their Facebook page through our page and check out a lot of the great offers they have available. And Ryan, we have two callers that are going to talk to you. Marianne is the first one from Covedale's got an AC question for you. Hi, Marianne. Thank you for holding.
Hi, Ryan. No problem. I had to replace my air conditioner this past year.
Okay.
And they had a very difficult time putting it in. They were going to call their dad to come and do it because they had so much trouble.
Okay.
And they had to replace something on the furnace. I can't remember what it was.
Okay.
And now my Duke bill has always been so high, and I turned the air conditioner off, but there's still air coming out of the vent.
Okay.
And I called the company, and the dad came. I wanted him to come look at it, and he said I need a new furnace.
Mm.
The I can't remember what it was they replaced on the furnace, but he said that the furnace and the air conditioner don't, like,
match up.
Right. Yeah. So the young men had replaced a metal piece that was in the shape of an A.
Okay.
And they said that it needed to be in the shape of an N.
Okay.
Do you follow me? Do you know what I'm talking about?
You're referring to the evaporator coil. Yep.
Okay. So anyway, they had a very difficult time with that. I thought the house was going to come down with them pounding on that.
Oh.
Anyway, do I need a new furnace?
Well, you know, that's it's a great question, and the one thing that I always recommend, even if it's one of our technicians that's out there, you can always ask for a second opinion. And to properly answer your question, I would really need to be at the home to find out what's wrong. But if your whole concern is just that there's still air coming out of the vents, you know, that could be something to do with the wiring when they wired up the new air conditioner. So it could be miswired. It could be maybe just a setting on your thermostat. So there is a setting on your thermostat that controls the fan, and it should be in the auto position, not the on position. If it's set to on, it will run 24/7, 365.
It is on auto.
Okay, perfect.
And it was 50 degrees out.
Mm-hmm.
My thermostat was set on 74.
Okay.
The reading was, I don't know, 69.
Okay.
And it was still blowing.
Not cold, but just blowing air.
Well, the air conditioner was on at the time.
Okay.
But I figured I was just wasting electricity, so then I turned the air conditioner off.
I gotcha.
Okay. But air was still coming out.
You know, there could be something that's just not wired or set up properly. So, you know, your air conditioner and your furnace, it's not like a refrigerator. You don't just, you know, put it in place and plug it in. They actually have to be wired and set up properly. So it's always good to have somebody who's a licensed individual, you know, come out and then just double check everything before you go purchasing a new furnace. Because, you know, it's a lot of money. It's a big part. So I would just, you know, to really get you taken care of properly, I'd just recommend getting a second opinion.
Okay, I can do that. No problem.
Well, Mary, I tell you what, it sounds like you have one more question, but I was going to suggest when we get finished talking with you, stay on the line. We'll get your number. And
give Ryan a call. You guys did great work.
I'll call you at your work.
Perfect.
How's that sound?
That's great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now we have Tommy on the line from Dry Ridge. Ryan's got a question for you about geothermal. Do you already have geothermal, Tommy?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead with your question.
I just wondered why you didn't put that in there as your preferred form of heating and air conditioning. And do you recommend geothermal or not recommend geothermal when you sell? Or
you know, I personally, as a technician, love geothermal. I love working on everything. But so, you know, as my preferred, why I didn't say geothermal is currently for most homeowners, that tax credit is gone. So there was that 30% rebate. And if I was building a newly constructed home, you know, I would have taken advantage of that because it would make sense to do it. But so I guess that's the answer to your question is currently there is no tax rebate and geothermal is pretty expensive, especially if you're retrofitting to an existing house because of the, you know, the, I guess, ideal setup for geothermal. Everybody doesn't have that. They might not have the landscape or, you know, the lake for the loop field, things like that. There's just several factors. So, but my go-to is always a hybrid system, natural gas or propane, paired with a heat pump is my preferred.
I see. So it's just basically price would be the only reason?
Yep, absolutely. My payback, you know, I would probably recoup that long term if I was living in a home and I knew this was going to be my forever house. I'm going to just design it the way that I want it. The tax credit was there. Heck yeah, I'd go geothermal. I just think it's very green. I'm all for saving, you know, money, and it also provides free hot water in the summertime. So,
right.
which is awesome. But not everybody has that luxury or, you know, the long term knowing that I'm going to be here. Most people have like a 5-year plan with a house.
Right.
And so for those people, it doesn't make sense to go geothermal. So
I see.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know, you said something real quick that I want to touch base on. So if you do a geothermal system, because a couple of my neighbors did,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't switch over to the hot water tank, they could go with a geothermal setup.
Okay.
Is that a big expense as well? And can you do that? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So geothermal is awesome. So, you know, all we're doing is we're pulling heat from out of the ground.
Right.
Or rejecting heat into the ground, depending on what season that we're in. And in the summertime, we have an abundance of heat, right, in the home. And we can reject that into a water heater. And so that can be done when you install it, or they can add it on, you know, later on. You can pipe that in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but geothermal, it's a little finicky and you have to have a technician come out. Like, it's not just like, oh yeah, we skipped out on maintenance this year. Like, you need a technician out there every 6 months.
Yeah.
Because in the summertime, we want that, it's called a hot water generator. There's a switch that that the technician can actually set up and switch. And so we switch that on in the summertime. And then when we come out and do the fall maintenance, we turn that off because you'll actually rob heat out of your water heater to heat the home if you have that on in the wintertime. So
it
needs attention. So
749 B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have our friend Ryan Houlihan in from Arling House Heating and Air. We need to pause for a moment. And when we come back, going to continue our conversation, going to talk a little bit about heat exchangers and carbon monoxide. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. We have our friend Ryan Houlihan in from Arling House Heating and Air. You can get to their website at arlinghouseair.com or jump onto their Facebook page. You can get to both of those through our page. And Ryan, I wanted to talk a little bit about the heat exchangers, if you can enlighten us. A lot of people often ask about those and maybe a little confusion.
Absolutely, yeah. So all you folks out there that have a gas furnace, the heart of your gas furnace is the heat exchanger. Mm-hmm. And if you were to envision, you know, your furnace as the firebox, right? Okay. The heat exchanger is what contains the fire. And we move air on the outside of that, and that's how we heat the home, okay? So It's a safety issue, and some people have had a technician in the past tell them that they have a cracked heat exchanger and that they need to replace their furnace. And so it's a semi-serious issue, because if we've got a crack in that metal box, then we have the potential for the fire and the gases to come into the livable space, right? The space that we're living in. Mm-hmm. And that has carbon monoxide and other stuff that you wouldn't want to breathe, right? You wouldn't pull your car into your living room and leave it running, right?
Right.
Because it's not good. Mm-hmm. And it can kill you. So that's what a heat exchanger is the firebox. And we want to make sure that the fire and the gases stay in the box. And so if it's cracked, it's a safety issue. The first thing to do, if somebody tells you that you have a cracked heat exchanger, is always get a second opinion. Okay. I'm a firm believer in second opinions, even if it's one of our technicians.
You know, I have to give you credit for saying that. There's an awful lot of businesses out there will just say, take my advice, get this done. And you have constantly, or I should say consistently, every time you've been on the show, say, even if it's one of our technicians,
yep,
get a second opinion.
Yeah, you know, and you don't have to go to another company to get a second opinion. If you don't trust the technician that's in your home, whether it's Arling House or not, you know, you can ask for another representative from that company to come out and verify what the first technician, you know, because we're human. We're all human. Technicians are human, and we make mistakes. And so it's always good to get a second opinion, and always ask for something tangible. Don't just take somebody's word for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tony, I don't remember if you remember, I showed you on that camera that I had.
That was from somewhere else. Was that? No, just kidding. I knew you were going to bring that up, but you did. Yeah, all kidding set aside. Yeah, you on that camera, you had a photograph of the cracked heat exchanger that we had down there at the florist.
Absolutely. So ask for something tangible. You know, I want to see it. I want to touch it. So technicians should be equipped, if they're identifying a cracked heat exchanger, they should be equipped with a camera, and they should be able to show you what they're looking at. And you know, even though that you may not know exactly what's on the screen, you know, particularly, it's always good to kind of have that visual, and maybe mm-hmm. they can give you a copy of it, you know, something like that, so that if another company or another technician comes out, you know, that they'll be able to find it and identify it as well. So it's always a good idea to get a second opinion, ask for something tangible. So
always best.
I took your word for it.
Well,
you were there working. I saw you with all the get up. So I, but that was really interesting to see. And you don't always know that you have those issues, but certainly something could, you know, something detrimental could come about of something, or as a result of having a cracked heat exchanger, right?
Absolutely. You know, there's about 20,000 to 30,000 hospital or ER visits every year for carbon monoxide poisoning. So that's like the big thing that everybody kind of knows and identifies with gas-fired appliances. Only about 500 people a year die from carbon monoxide. You know, yeah, so with the cameras and everything, so, you know, we show the cracks, they don't always produce carbon monoxide. Mm-hmm. They just have the potential to
right,
do so.
Right.
But we also have tools to actually identify if there is an immediate safety issue, like right now, you know, kind of thing,
sure,
which is called a combustion analyzer. So all of our technicians are equipped with combustion analyzers. We do those on tune-ups. There's no extra charge for it. It's incorporated in our safety check.
Is there a specific type of CO2 detector that you would recommend that really gets down to that micro level?
Absolutely.
That will sense anything of the sort?
So, you know, Ernie at Mammy's house,
yeah,
there, that,
yeah,
that carbon monoxide detector is the best one. It's not one that you can buy online or in stores.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually one we have to go get training. And I have a certification from this company,
mm-hmm,
in order to be able to purchase their carbon monoxide detectors. And they are 100% the best carbon monoxide detectors that are out there, because they're low level. They have a low level sensor and a high level sensor.
And I have to testify to that. I called you when my mother-in-law, who had said there's a beeping going on. So I went over to the house to investigate. And walked over to the unit, called your number, and you said that's a low-level alarm. And the first thing you ask is, does she have a gas stove?
Yep.
And I said, matter of fact, she does. And walk in there and see if anything's on. And sure enough, she had bumped one of the knobs, and that was the source of the alarm. So I got to tell you, it was spectacular. It performed well. You were great in responding. And, You know, it could have been a catastrophe there.
Always happy to help. But, you know, those low-level detectors are awesome. Like, I would want to know, you know, I always kind of joke with people. It's like, if you were swimming in the ocean, would you want to know that there's a shark in the water before or after it bites you?
I like that analogy.
So, like, most people want to know before.
Yeah.
So, having a low-level detector that will detect down to, you know, the actual specific measurement would be somewhere between 30 and 70 parts per million. You know, that's not life-threatening. There's no reason to panic at a low level. And you have time to react, to do something about it before you call 911 or something like that.
I have two questions related to that. Where would you position that CO2 detector?
It's a great question. So, and I'll start with the most common one that we see that's purchased are the plug-in ones. But there's a problem with plug-in carbon monoxide detectors. They're convenient, but... You know, carbon monoxide is slightly lighter than air, so it tends to build up towards the top of the room. And, you know, where are most of your plugs?
Down low.
Down low, right? And so that's not where you're going to have the highest levels of concentration, down low. So the most ideal placement is the first place is near the bedroom. That is about eye level, 5 to 6 feet off the ground, because we want to know what the carbon monoxide level is where we breathe. Right? Mm-hmm. Not down at the plug. So having a battery operated one that's mounted on the wall about eye level is the best placement. Secondary placement would be near the thermostat, because usually the thermostat is in a good central location in the home.
Right.
And if you have a low level detector, I mean, that is like the best protection that you can possibly have.
And what would one expect to pay for something like what Mammy has?
So that particular one we sell currently, it's right around $200 installed, and it does come with I believe it's a 5-year parts warranty and a 1-year labor guarantee.
So. Worth every penny.
Absolutely.
I can tell you firsthand, worth every penny.
They joke around with that one in the training class is that if you have a low-level detector, that low-level detector, they can't technically sell it as a smoke detector, but it'll pick up the carbon monoxide from a fire before the smoke detectors pick up the smoke. So
it was absolutely amazing how effective it was and how quickly it identified the problem, and we got it resolved before anything bad could happen.
Absolutely.
749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Ryan Houlihan from Arlinghouse Heating and Air. Always learn so much when you're in with us. And before you go, give us your contact information one more time.
Yeah, it's 859-727-9000. Arlinghouseair.com is the website. The website's got a lot of great coupons that you guys can go out and check on. And also visit our Facebook page as well.
In and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and garden guys. Have a great weekend. Get to your locally owned, independently operated garden center, and then get outside. It's gorgeous out. We'll talk to you next week.